Trainer Talks and Tales acknowledges the traditional owners and custodians of the land in which we're recording this podcast, the Turrbal and Yugara people of Meanjin. We pay our respects to elders past and present and extend our respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today.
Trainer Talks and Tales love having an array of guests with a variety of opinions. However, the views of the individuals do not necessarily reflect the perspectives of the host facilities.
Hey everyone, and welcome to another episode of Trainer Talks and Tales. You're of course joined by Tess and Daisy. Hey Daisy, how has your week been?
Hey Tess, hi everyone. My week has been good. We've had a really quiet week at work with guests, so it's been really nice to put a little bit more time into the animals and pick up on some new training, some maintenance behaviours, and getting prepped for our annual breeding season with our penguins, which is starting soon, which is super exciting. But I kind of wanted to talk about a little bit briefly just about our episode last week, because it has been, well, thank you. And to start with, to everyone who's given us such lovely feedback, it's been great to hear. And we really love hearing when you guys enjoy the episodes that we put out. But it's been really good reflecting on that episode and reflecting a little bit on my presentation skills. And it's been really cool chatting to a couple of the girls at work who have listened to the episode as well. And we're all feeling super motivated to kind of change up our presentation, have a real think about what we're saying and what our why is behind our presentations, which I think is really important and something that's quite easy to kind of forget about as well when we're out there. So I'm looking forward to the next sort of couple of months with using all of that energy from Michael and all of this new motivation to change up our presentations and have a real good think about what we're doing. How about you though? Yeah, How's your week been?
Oh no, I was just going to say, I agree completely. And you and I were very inspired by that and we hold that still and we keep talking about it, but I feel exactly the same way. I recorded some of the presentations today and listened back with my staff and listened to my own and a bit of reflection. And as Michael said too, it's not criticizing yourself. It can be like, oh man, I really like that I do that. So it's all about growth. So I completely agree. So
yeah.
Love that.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Such a good episode. But Tess, I feel like by the time this episode comes out, you're gonna have one day left of work.
Yes.
How are you doing?
Might even be finished. Yeah. No, really good. Three shifts left and feeling great. So very excited to put my feet up, that's for sure.
Yeah, definitely.
To wrap up. All right, well, getting into this episode, we are joined by Erin, who works at SeaWorld. This is actually an episode that's been requested a few times because we wanted to get into a bit of terminology, some definitions. So hopefully you have a bit more of a clearer understanding of this episode. But of course, we do endeavor to always explain some terms every episode and get a little bit more into the nitty gritty if you haven't quite understood what we've been saying. So hopefully this clears this up a little bit. We love this episode. Hope you did too.
Erin, thank you so much for joining Tess and I on Trainer Talks and Tales today. We are so excited to chat to you, and we feel like this topic we're going to discuss today is something that everyone is going to benefit from hearing from. But you probably know, before we get into our questions, we'd love to start with our fast five. So are you happy if we get straight into that?
Yeah, let's get to it.
Okay, question number one, dolphins or penguins?
Dolphins, dolphin girl at heart.
Question two, cheese or chocolate?
Ooh, a little bit of ash brie with a bit of dark chocolate at the same time.
Okay, question number three, next country that you are visiting?
I'm going to Japan on Thursday.
Woohoo! Red or white wine?
White wine.
And finally, a tough one for you, Californian or Australian sea lions?
Daisy, I know that you know the answer to this. I'm and will always be an Australian sea lion girl. They are the most iconic, charismatic species of seal. And if you have never been lucky enough to meet one, look up an image of an Australian sea lion online and you will fall in love as well. They are just so amazing.
Do you have a particular favorite Australian sea lion, Erin?
Oh, look, you know what? I have been told many times over my career that we're not meant to have favorites, but everybody knows that there's a a really special seal called Tore, who was actually born down at Taronga Zoo, and we were lucky enough to have him come up and join us 2 years ago at SeaWorld. He is just, every now and then you come across an animal in when you're working with an animal, and they just get you, and you get them, and it just works. And for me, he's one of those rare few. So his name's Tore, and now he is huge. He's a big glowing male, but he's just such a really cool animal to work with.
I've only had the pleasure of meeting Tore briefly, but it was a very special time for me after we lost one of our sea lions at Sea Life, and I was in the floods of tears to Erin, and she ran me down to meet Tore, and I had a big Aussie sea lion cuddle, which made me feel so much better. So I'll always remember that special time with him.
Yeah, the animals, definitely can bring you through those really tough moments. We're so lucky to work with the animals that we do work with, and I think it's really important that we do take that time and really fill our cup, because, you know, there are times like what you were dealing with that where your cup is quite empty. So, yeah, when a Tore cuddle is needed, I'm always happy to help out.
Yes. Well, like I said, Erin, we're both so grateful that you're joining us today. We would love for you to maybe share a little bit of an insight into what your career has kind of looked like and what you're up to now.
Okay, well, I started volunteering at SeaWorld when I was fresh out of doing my Bachelor of Science. So I'm talking like almost 20 years ago. So I started volunteering at SeaWorld, where I volunteered in a department called Animal Care, which looked after seals, penguins, the dugongs at the time, and some pelicans. And then I was lucky enough to score a casual job, which quickly turned into a part-time job. And while I was doing that, I started volunteering in the dolphin department of Dolphin Bay, so the interactive dolphin department, and then was able to transfer across there really quickly, spent 5, maybe 6 years just learning all things dolphins, which was just incredible, mostly the dolphin interactive programs, and then moved over to the Dolphin Beach area where I did learn the presentations and working a subspecies of dolphin. The offshore bottlenose dolphin, and then I was lucky enough to move over to Seal Theatre, where I got to work over there for 8 years with three different species of seal and also some really cool pelicans. And then I have recently taken on a team leader role back in Animal Care, so I've come full circle. And now I manage a group of 10 pinnipeds, about 37 penguins, little blue penguins, some rehab pelicans, and also one really cool little brown booby bird.
Wow, what an impressive collection you got there.
Yeah, look, I'm not gonna lie, my role is super busy, but I'm really lucky we've got those three collections of animals, and they're all in different stages in their training, but it's just a lot of fun. It's a lot of work, but it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, have you ever felt like you've missed out on any opportunities or learning from not working at another facility? Have you felt like you've gained everything from being at SeaWorld?
Interesting question. Look, I am really lucky to have had the opportunity at SeaWorld to move into different departments. So I'm learning different taxa, learning from a lot of different supervisors, but also we've had some great leadership come through SeaWorld in the form of our Director of Marine Sciences, Wayne Phillips, who's actually brought in a lot of really amazing resources. So I've sort of found that while I hit the point where I was like, is this as far as I'm going to learn, he has just brought in so much. So we've been so lucky to be able to have some mentorship from some of the world's experts in behavioral conditioning, including, you know, the big names of the industry, like Ken Ramirez and Susan Friedman and Peter Gilliam. Like, we've just been really, really lucky. So yeah, I do think that maybe I have lived a sheltered life, but I've also been very aware to make sure I am putting myself out there. So going to things like IMARTA, which is the International Marine Animal Trainers Association, and also the ABMA conferences, things like that have really helped me learn and grow. So there are advantages to staying in one facility, as long as you make the effort to learn and grow.
Yeah, I agree. I've only been at my facility throughout my entire career, and there's moments where you do have bits of self-doubt or the grass is always greener, but I think you surmise that perfectly, that there's always opportunity to grow. And there's always going to be new things on the horizon. So it sounds like you've had an incredible career at SeaWorld. Did you want to go into a little bit more detail about what the day in the life of your role currently looks like?
Yeah, sure. So a day in animal care, being a team leader in animal care, is super busy. So we start at six. We do a 10-hour shift. So we're in six till four. My day involves everything that you can imagine, including food prep, cleaning exhibits, as many training sessions as I can squeeze in, both with our penguins, our pelicans, and of course our pinnipeds. We also have a really amazing enrichment program. So obviously trying to focus on that as well. We have certain goals that we're trying to meet, behavioral goals each day. So trying to do that as well as observations. But basically within our training sessions, I'm trying to achieve three different types of training sessions at minimum a day, as in I'm trying to do a behavioral learning, so some sort of learning opportunity for the seals, some form of enrichment, plus some sort of form of husbandry training. So, and then obviously any other sessions as well. So I have certain key goals that I'm trying to achieve with our team. I'm also trying to grow a team of really great people into being really well-rounded trainers. So trying to coach them as well. So as you can imagine, I wear many hats in a day, but definitely it's a really good job. I'm very, very lucky.
And you said you have 37 penguins, is that right? I have 17 and we struggle with that. So 37 is crazy.
37 penguins is a lot, and I'm not going to lie, it did take me a little while to figure out who was who, but now I have it done. It honestly, 37 is actually a really great number. So we've got a really great social grouping, and Daisy, as you know, up here in the northern areas, we are obviously coming into breeding season, and it's just so much fun. Yeah, it's a lot. These guys crack me up with their little social antics. I've never been a birdie. I've never claimed to be a birdie. But here am I looking after this gorgeous collection of little blues. And there is one little guy in that exhibit. His name's Han. He's 18 years old and he's just a delight. So when I first started working in animal care, he originally would only eat in the water, which I know sounds completely normal. It's a great behavior to have. However, I'm trying to run a behavioral conditioning program with Han. So I really want to achieve some voluntary behaviors with him. So asking him to come out of the water was a really big step for him. So we actually taught him with really small successive approximations to come out and eat on land. Now, by him coming out and eating on land, I was able to achieve things like him coming out and doing a voluntary weigh. So rather than physically picking him up and, you know, weighing him, I was actually allowing him to actively participate in his own healthcare. So things like that for an 18-year-old penguin who has only eaten in the water for 18 years, being able to use successive approximations to ask him to come up and stand on a set of scales just through the power of positive reinforcement was so empowering. It was really cool to see.
What an achievement.
Yeah, he's quite the little man. He's definitely got a space in my heart, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's amazing to hear. Congratulations on that. Such a huge success. Now, you have obviously shared all of your experience. You have so much incredible experience. So we thought you're probably going to be the perfect person for us to chat a little bit about some common training terminology that we hear and use quite frequently within our roles. Being that we primarily use this, could you maybe start us off with explaining what we're talking about when we use the words operant conditioning?
Yeah, absolutely. So, well, first of all, let's go right back to basics. So training is traditionally broken up into two different conditioning techniques. We've got classical and then we've got operant conditioning. So classical, or sometimes it's called respondent conditioning, it describes an involuntary or automatic response to a stimulus. So one of the most famous examples of this was actually from Pavlov's dog experiment, when he was regularly, the dogs were given food straight after a bell was ringing. And after a while, the dog began to anticipate what was happening. So the dog would actually hear the bell ringing and start to salivate or drool a little bit expecting the food. So it was a basically it's an involuntary response, whereas operant conditioning, and I've gone straight to the ABMA glossary of terms to get my wording absolutely correct. It says it focuses on the learning in which behavior is influenced by its consequences. So the probability that a behavior will occur again in the future increases if it's followed by a reinforcer and decreases if the behavior is followed by a punisher. It's broken up into four quadrants. So when we're talking about operant conditioning, there is four, imagine like a pie graph with four quarters in it. So we've got the positive reinforcement, positive punishment, negative reinforcement, and then negative punishment. So when we're saying positive or negative, positive just refers to the addition of a stimulus, and the negative just refers to the removal of a stimulus. So at the end of the day, to make it really simple, is basically that we are focusing on the learning that is influenced by the consequences that come after the learning.
Yeah, that's perfect. I think
you said that very well.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely. And I it really made sense to me as well when you looked at that. Positive is adding, negative is removing. Like, that was the simplest way for me to learn with that too.
Yeah, it does get tricky. I mean, when you're sort of adding the positive and negatives, but when you break it down, it's just you're adding or removing the consequence to the environment to increase the future frequency of the behavior that it follows. So for example, if you give a dog a treat every time it sits, the dog's going to be more likely to sit.
Absolutely. So you've mentioned that operant conditioning is split into these four quadrants, and we focus primarily on using positive reinforcement in our animal training. Can you provide a bit of a breakdown of what positive reinforcement actually is?
Yeah, absolutely. So at the end of the day, when we're training animals, we're going to use the least intrusive, most positive methods. So that's where positive reinforcement comes from. So when you're looking at positive reinforcement, we're just going to add a consequence into the environment in order to increase the future frequency of that behavior that it follows. So for me, for example, if I am asking a seal to, for example, to lay down, and it lays down nice and calm, I'm going to add something into their environment, most likely something of primary reinforcement, which would be something they want to eat. And that will actually increase the likelihood of that behavior happening again.
Have you found within your career that that sort of reinforcement differs depending on the species that you've worked with as well, and that it's been pretty important to be aware of that prior to going into training with those animals?
Oh, absolutely. So again, when you're training animals, everybody knows that if you have a really great understanding of what that animal seems, or you perceive that animal seems to enjoy, that is obviously going to increase the likelihood of the behavior. So I have worked with one dolphin in particular. Her name is Scooter, and she gets all the new trainers, but she just doesn't like squid. So if you didn't know that and you went in there with a bucket of food and you ask Scooter to do something and she comes back and you give her a squid 100 times out of 100, you will have that squid promptly come back in the face. So knowing your animal is so incredibly important. So you do need to know what that animal finds inherently reinforcing. So, and there are times when it won't be primary reinforcement. It might be something like giving them access to a conspecific, or it might be moving them into an environment where they actually really would really find reinforcing, or they want to be. So I guess we're kind of going into things like the Premack principle. We start talking about those things, but yeah, definitely it's not always food based, it really just means you really do need to know what your animal finds inherently reinforcing.
And can you just briefly explain what a conspecific is?
Yes, absolutely. So a conspecific is basically another animal of the same sort of species. So for a seal, it would be another seal.
And so you kind of touched briefly earlier a little bit about the other three that fall into the quadrant. And I actually recommended a podcast, and I'm pretty sure you touched on it as well, with Ken Ramirez, who touched on negative reinforcement, which is one of those quadrants. We've also got negative punishment and positive punishment. Do you think you could possibly provide a few examples maybe that could assist with explaining those terms. So we don't usually see them used as frequently in facilities as we do positive reinforcement.
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing I've actually found quite interesting is recently there has been a lot of talk about negative reinforcement throughout the industry. So at the ABMA conference last year, there were some amazing presentations on it. And one of your guests actually did an amazing presentation on it, Bianca. So Bianca actually presented it. But basically, let's go through it first. So negative reinforcement is removing a consequence from the environment in order to increase the future frequency of the behavior. So the most common example that people use is usually pressure on a rein to steer a horse. So you're actually removing that the pressure on one side, which will actually make the horse turn. But Bianca's example of it was actually, she was talking about a macaw at Gumbaya World, and she was actually talking about this bird who kept biting every time a hand was presented. So she actually was using negative reinforcement, where if the parrot leaned away, the hand was removed. So she was actually negatively, so taking away the thing that the animal was avoiding, and it, by taking away that hand, it was more likely to allow it to come in. Bianca explained it beautifully. Maybe you need to get her back on to explain it. It's a bit of a movement in the industry. So when you listen to Ken talk about it, a lot of very, very experienced trainers are doing it without even realizing they're actually using that negative reinforcement. If you're just starting out, 100%, always go positive reinforcement. You're adding something into the environment to increase the likelihood rather than taking something out of the environment. So Bianca's example was she was taking the hand out of the environment to increase the likelihood of the bird coming closer to her, which, yeah, it was really clever, really, really clever.
Yeah, that's really awesome. We have tried that a little bit with our penguin colony with some of the animals that are a little bit more hesitant towards doing tactile stuff, which we did have a little bit of success with as well. Do you want to touch on the other two as well? Sorry, Tess.
Yeah, sorry.
Okay, so let's talk about negative punishment. So negative punishment is the procedure of removing a consequence from the environment in order to decrease the future frequency of the behavior that it follows. The most common example of negative punishment is probably using a timeout. So you're actually removing the opportunity for the animal to earn reinforcement. So you're actually completely leaving the scenario. So you're taking negatively, so you're removing the opportunity for the consequence to happen. So you're decreasing the likelihood of the behavior that it has followed.
Nailed it. Yeah, that's a really good explanation. That's really easy to, like, that makes a lot of logical sense.
So obviously you're not going to use negative punishment often, but it is a tool in your belt. So you can actually completely remove yourself when you're taking away the negatively, so removing the reinforcement. And then obviously the final one we're going to talk about is positive punishment. So positive just means adding. So you're adding a consequence to the environment in order to decrease the future frequency of the behavior that it follows. We all, without even knowing it, get used, and we have a positive punishment used on us every single day when we hop in our car. If you get in your car and you start driving, what does your car do if you haven't put your seatbelt on?
Ding, 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 ding.
Yeah. So therefore, you're adding a consequence into your environment, and it will likely decrease the future of your behavior. So the dinging makes you go, huh, haven't put my seatbelt on. I'm going to put my seatbelt on. And then next time when you hop in the car, do you want to hear the sound? What was it, Daisy?
Ding, 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 ding.
Yeah. Or put your seatbelt on. So that's probably the most eloquent example of positive punishment that we all have in our lives every single day.
I love it. I think that was very well explained. Now we have a couple more definitions to get through. Whether it's the marine or terrestrial world, generally I have found that the terrestrial world is still using the word Q, and Daisy obviously has been using SD at her facility. I did have someone ask me whether it was the letter Q. It's C-U-E for Q. So I can understand that confusion with SD. Do you mind just defining what a Q or what an SD is?
Yeah, absolutely. So a cue is basically an antecedent stimulus that signals a specific behavior, and that if that behavior is emitted, it will be reinforced. So we also refer to it, as you said, as an SD, which stands for discriminative stimulus. I don't know why.
It's so confusing.
But that's what it stands for. So for example, a cue or an SD, you might be asking an animal to lay down by pointing your finger down. If the behavior is correct, we're going to reinforce it. So a cue or an SD can be visual, so a hand cue. It can be verbal, like a word. It could be touch in a certain spot on the animal. It could be a geographical cue, so anytime you stand in a certain location, or it could even be a scent cue. And I have used a combination of all of the above. So that's a cue.
Now, during that, you kind of touched on some of the different types of cues that we might utilize within our days. For me, generally at work, we generally lead towards our visual, verbal, or sometimes even our geographical cues as well. And Tess, most of the time it's visual cues for you as well. But Erin, you did mention a little bit about scent cues. Do you want to maybe touch on what that kind of involves? I'm excited.
Well, scent cues isn't a new thing, but it is something that can be quite challenging to train, but it's a lot of fun for the animals. So we have a few animals that we work with within the animal care department who might not have the best eyesight or the best mobility. So this is actually quite a cognitive challenging sort of concept for them. But what we are doing is presenting a smell. So for example, it might be the smell of lemon, or it might be the smell of rosemary or orange, and associating that as a cue for a specific behavior. So you might have the smell of orange, for example, might be a cue for a wave, and rosemary might be the cue for lay down. So basically we're teaching the animals to smell and have a think about it and discriminate, which is exactly what the SD stands for. It's a discriminative stimulus, that between another behavior. So it's actually quite an interesting, fun one to train.
That's really cool. I'd love to see that in action with some of your animals next time we come down.
Always welcome, Daisy. Love to show you.
We did talk about that in one of our earlier episodes with elephants. So it's cool to think that other species are doing it as well. What species are doing that kind of scent training at SeaWorld?
Mostly the pinnipeds, but I wouldn't put it past some of the bear keepers to eventually get on board with that as well, because it is a lot of fun. I mean, I know the bear keepers are actually doing a lot of really fun stuff, offering different scents, and we actually donate some of our seal, we call it seal juice, but it's probably because it's brown. From where they've been laying in their beds, and they will actually offer this to the bears for a different scent enrichment. But mostly just scent training with the seals at the moment. Obviously don't do it with dolphins because they can't smell, but there is always potential for the penguins, Daisy.
Ooh, that would be a cool little challenge in the future.
Now, can you break down what ABC stands for and means for us next, please?
Okay, so ABC is an acronym for antecedent, behavior, and consequence. So it indicates that there's an interrelationship between these elements in regards to the reinforcement theory. So antecedent is an event or a stimulus that immediately precedes a behavior and influences the occurrence of the behavior. And then you have the behavior itself, and then the consequence. So the consequence is an event or stimulus that immediately follows the behavior and influences the probability that the behavior will occur again. So ABCs, we do them all the time. So your antecedent will be like you're, we often talk about, especially at SeaWorld, we talk about the antecedent arrangement. So it might be, what are you setting up within the environment to set up success for the behavior to happen? So the consequence, which will be the animal receiving the reinforcement. So you might be looking at, say, Han asking the little blue penguin to come on out, and the antecedent arrangement would be making sure that the scales are flat, so they're not going to wobble. So you're setting up your environment perfectly so he can come on, complete his behavior, and have the consequence, which is the reinforcement, happen. Now, the biggest thing I want to point out here is we always talk about ABCs, but we need to really highlight that this is really a feedback loop, so that the past consequences are tomorrow's antecedents. So if Han was to step on the scales, they were to wobble and scare him, that's actually going to affect tomorrow's session. So if he gets a fright today, he's not actually going to be wanting to come back and hop on his little set of scales tomorrow. So the past consequences are definitely tomorrow's antecedents. And I think that's a huge one to remember.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point that you mentioned at the end, something really important to think about, and just how important those antecedents can be in setting up your behavior to be successful as well. Now, speaking a little bit about the behavior element of that, could you maybe touch on what it means when we sort of say a behavior is or isn't under stimulus control as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So if a behavior is under stimulus control, it just refers to the extent to which a behavior is influenced by the presentation of a specific stimuli. So the behavior is under stimulus control if it tends to occur exclusively in the presence of your cue. So if I'm asking a seal to wave and I'm doing the cue and the animal is presenting that behavior, I could say that this behavior is under stimulus control.
Makes sense. And obviously you're very passionate about concept training. Can you touch on what concept training actually means and the benefits to our animals?
Yeah, look, I have been playing around with concepts probably for the last 5 years, but basically when we're talking about concepts, it's the, let's go with the introduction of novel concepts which utilize a generalized conditioned stimulus as a cue to elicit response according to the type of concepts that we are doing. So I've seen benefit because they provide a lot of variability, they provide intellectual stimulation and a lot of enrichment into learning sessions. And I've been able to really effectively use the concepts in predictable scenarios. So things like presentations, encounters, husbandry sessions. So I'm actually, yeah, sure, we're doing the same thing. However, I'm giving you a lot of different things to think about within this space. So when we're talking about concepts, each of these concepts have a really basic framework with each concept using a sequence of cues. So this is where I just had Joe Walker from Taronga come up and I showed her these and she, her little brain was blown. It was really cool to have another colleague come from another facility, but just showing how clever these animals are. And you start small, but they just really provide animals in professional care with a really stimulating and challenging environment. And that's one of the biggest key components in achieving our animal welfare goals. So I love it. There's so much in the concept training space.
Yeah. And I love actually when we spoke to Bianca, she really said, which I kind of heard and I really like that she said this, that often we'll refer to it as cognitive training, but pretty much everything we do is cognitive training to the animals. So making that into that little bit smaller bubble of concept training really highlights that mental stimulation. I cannot wait to come down and see some of the stuff that you've been doing with some of your seals, but could you maybe share some of the concept training you have been working on over the last couple of years?
Yeah, absolutely. So, okay, so I'll run through a selection of the different concepts that I've used with varying success to different individuals. So some of the animals I have seen have really flourished with some of these different concepts and some haven't, but I've always found something that some type of concept for the animals. So
first of all, started really simple with a repeat, which is a relatively straightforward behavior where the previous behavior is actually asked again by using a repeat SD or a repeat cue. So this was the first one we taught to many of them, and it was really interesting to see that after several behaviors were individually taught on the repeat cue, some of the individuals that we were working with actually were able to generalize the concept. So they saw that repeat cue and they knew exactly what that meant. Whereas some, however, needed to be trained that each individual behavior could be repeated. So it was really interesting to see that. So once we went with the repeat, we moved on to the wait and go. So it was just an extension from the repeat where we did a wait cue, which really generalized the concept. And then we did the individual behavior cue. And then we followed that by a go cue. So, so we said wait, maybe wave, and then go. The pause time between the presentation of the behavior and the go was then slowly extended. So we could actually say wait, do the behavior, wait a couple of seconds, and then go. We saw the same thing with repeat. Some seals were able to generalize the concept. Some of the dolphins probably generalized it a lot quicker. However, we did have those who needed to have each individual behavior applied to the concept. So once the seals mastered the concept of wait and go, we moved on to the marked behavior, which extended the memory between the wait and go. And so I would formally mark a behavior. So rather than using a wait or a wait cue, I actually did a marked behavior cue, and then would tell them what behavior to remember. And then that would mean that the behavior would be remembered and it would be committed to their memory. So I would later ask the mark later on, whether it was in a presentation or a training session on the cue. So essentially I was asking the seal to recall a previously marked behavior. Now I can go all day trying to remember something and get to the end of the day and go, oh my God, what is it? But I have had seals blow my brains and be actually able to remember the thing I've asked them to remember from the day before, to the point where I've had to start writing it down because sometimes I forget what I've asked them. So I have really successfully used the mark behavior in presentations and also during a photo session with an animal ambassador animal. So being able to really test them out and figuring out how good they can remember is really cool. But the benefits of doing these is huge because the animals really do seem to really focus on us, which is great. Well, those were really cool. Then we have sort of gone on to sequence the behaviors or to combine behaviors. So some of the guys over in our dolphin areas are actually doing some great stuff where they're actually asking the animals to combine behaviors. So, you know, the animals can do two things at once, which not everybody can do. And then I've had some seals who just didn't sort of understand the repeat, wait and go framework. And I have used a really great one, which has been around forever, called the Innovate or You Choose. We've sort of passed that over to you guys up there as well, Daisy. But the fun of this behavior is basically I'm always using the same cue. So I'm saying next, I'm presenting the same cue. And each time I present that cue, the only criteria is that the animal needs to do something different. And it doesn't need to be a formal behavior, because obviously they're only going to have a limited amount of waves or salutes or laydowns. It just needs to be a different body movement. And I've just had so much fun with this with our amazing little fur seals. We've got a really great fur seal named Carter. Carter came in to us to SeaWorld with a big shark bite on his back. He's also had eye problems. So he is limited with his movement and his vision, but he is not mentally limited. So I've been able to really give him a new way to think. And so Carter will come out and he will do these crazy moves where he's body grooming, he's upside down, he's got his flippers up over his head, because he can be as creative as he wants to be. So that's been a really fun one to train. We've also done a Who Am I? which we did with one of our geriatric California sea lions, where each trainer was the cue themselves. So Wendell had to basically say, I would say, who am I? And I was a vocal. One of the other trainers would ask, who am I? And she was a grin. So we were able to give quite an old California sea lion a different way to think as well. And then we've done match to samples. But the most fun one that we have has been an absolute gift. And we've actually inherited a really amazing piece of technology from the US Navy. It is called an enclosure video enrichment system, or Eve, as we call her. She's so clever, this computer, that she's got her own name. Basically, it's a cursor training game where the animal is moving a blue circle into a black square by manipulating a computer with four buttons. So it's cognitive enrichment, it's variability, it gives them choice and control within their environment. And today I had the most successful session because I asked one of our California sea lion females to do a blood sampling session. And Claire came in, she got the sample of blood. Rosie obviously got a massive form of reinforcement, but she also got even better reinforcement. So we're talking about what she finds reinforcing. In the form of going to play Eve. So she got a fish and then I sent her in and her eyes lit up and this girl was all over the screen. I have never seen an animal just absolutely light up like this. So the value in being able to offer these sorts of cognitive enrichment, the variability, the choice and control all within their little environment is huge. So I just love where the industry is going and the opportunities that we're able to give the animals, because this one's a good one. You got to come and see it, Daisy.
Oh, I am absolutely coming down to see it. Like, that is, it's fascinating. And I'm always blown away by cooperative care training, but concept training is just so interesting. And it's clearly so able to provide such an incredible mental stimulation and increase positive welfare for all of those animals. And I remember the first time I saw Innovate being done and I was like, is this real? Are we actually doing this? It's amazing. And I'm loving watching the primaries do it with some of the seals after spending some time with you. Quick question though, don't dive in too deep, but do you train the weight or the go first?
Weight.
Okay, cool. I'm just interested with that one. That's a really interesting concept.
A lot of reasons. And I have tried the go first, but definitely I do the weight first. But everybody trains seals differently.
We saw a little bit of that training with the mark behavior when we were at the conference last year, and it was really cool. And honestly, I had forgotten what it was at the start of the session, but by the time that they did the session, they're like, this was the mark behavior. I was like, oh yeah, I remember that. So yeah, they're smarter than me for sure. Easy. Now we have a couple of questions that we had from our listeners. The first one was, what kind of cooperative care training do you do daily?
We do it all. So basically, we have an amazing preventative medical program that we run at SeaWorld. So we have certain things that we need to achieve with the animals within a certain period. So some things might be daily, some things might be weekly, monthly, or quarterly, or even 6 monthly. So in order to achieve these goals, we obviously are going to be working on these. And as I said, we try and do some form of husbandry every single day. But the more challenging ones, like a blood sampling session, we are going to be working on those daily, if not, you know, through several times throughout the week. But what we're doing is a really high ratio of really low discomfort sessions. So you're not going to stick an animal every single time you go to do a blood session. We're going lots of novelty. So we might today, like we had some animals come down and Claire just came and she was just patting the animals in the area where she's going to be taking blood. So really low discomfort sessions. She gets lots of those. And then we will actually, when we are doing an animal and sticking an animal, we'll actually really highly reinforce it, but it won't be every day. So when we're talking about the cooperative care, we are doing those daily. So, you know, within your session, whenever you're going into an animal, you're always checking the animals right over. And I'm sure every zookeeper in the country does this. You know, when you're getting eyes on an animal, you're looking at their eyes, their teeth, their body condition, how they're walking, and just their normal things. But then things like ultrasounds, x-rays, toothbrushing, blood sampling. We train voluntary vaccinations, eye swabs, we're doing it all. And we just try and make sure we cover it all every day. So it's a lot, but we don't obviously ask all of those individual things every day, but throughout the week, the animal will definitely get opportunities to complete each of these sessions.
I love that you referred to it. I actually took a note that you referred to it as a preventative medical care program. I think that's really important to highlight it in that way. Like, obviously we're doing cooperative care program, but it is, at the end of the day, it's preventative medicine, and it's what enables our animals to live so much longer and such a fulfilling life within our care. So love that, stealing that.
Yeah.
Now, the last question was actually someone asked about whether it's okay to go back in approximation. So I thought it might be a good opportunity to chat about what an actual approximation is, and then, of course, whether you do think it's okay to go back in approximations if necessary.
Absolutely. So an approximation is basically a single step in a progressive series that leads to your behavioral goal. So when we're looking at, for example, a voluntary blood sample session, you're not just going to go straight in there and ask the animal to lay down, roll over, and put a needle in them. There is lots of tiny, tiny, tiny little steps that you're going to take to condition this. And absolutely, I will always step back multiple approximations throughout the session. I want to reinforce every single part of this behavior. So for example, if I'm asking an animal to do that blood layout, they will lay down and roll over. But of course, I'm still going to reinforce the animal for laying down to start with. So I think it's really important to make sure you are reinforcing different parts of that behavior. So yes, going back. But if an animal does get to a point where they have something, the consequence has caused the behavior to break down a little bit, then absolutely you are going to go back multiple approximations to build up the animal's trust. I think that's really important.
Yeah, definitely. I totally agree with you. And I think you put that really nicely and really clearly for people to understand. Erin, honestly, I wish we had all the time in the world, because I feel like we could talk to you about, we could talk about training forever. It's such a fascinating topic. And I know it's something that's so close to your heart, and it's super close to me and Tess as well. I know so many people are going to get so much out of hearing from you today. So thank you so much for sharing your time and sharing all of your experience, all of your knowledge. It's been so fun chatting with you, and we're super grateful.
No worries. It's been a lot of fun. And as always, if anyone has any questions or there's anything they want to know or want to see examples, just reach on out. I'm happy to help out anyone. We are all one big family, this crazy animal industry that we work in. Absolutely reach on out. Or if I'm sure Daisy will probably be able to answer the questions as well, though.
Oh, just, I'm excited to come down and see all of your new things. We will be there soon, don't you worry.
Love it. Yep, look forward.
Thank you so much, Erin.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you, Erin. We'll speak to you soon. Guys, we really hope that you enjoyed that episode and was able to learn a little bit from Erin. She has so much experience, and I can assure you that she is absolutely considered a mentor to so many people. And for me, definitely a distant mentor as well. I'm very lucky to have learned a lot from Erin along the way, and hope to look forward to learning more from her in the future as well. And Tess and I are definitely going to head down to SeaWorld and see some of that incredible concept training that she chats about in this episode too.
Very much looking forward to it. Thanks so much. Hope you enjoy the rest of your week. See ya.
Thanks, guys.